Welcome to the Weight Loss for Women podcast, where we teach you how to break free from restrictive diets, restore your metabolism, and build a body you love so you can look and feel your best as you age. All right, let's dive into this episode.
I'm Kitty Bloomfield, co-founder of New Strength and Saturated, creator of Pro Metabolic Food Supplements and Seriously Saturated Skincare. And today we have Jay Feldman back on the podcast. He actually came on, like, it would be years ago, I think. Hey.
Easily, yeah. Yeah, maybe 5 years. I don't know.
Oh, it could be, because I feel like it would have been 3 years, I think. It was when we very first sort of started the podcast. And he's a health coach. He's got his own podcast. He coaches people. I think you really blew up too after you went on, what's his name, Dr. McCullough's podcast. How was that?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
It was great to be able to spread, you know, the message to so many people. So
I agree. And it's so good. Kate's been on there. Tomo's been on there. It's really good to, Georgie as well. Hey, Georgie was on there too. It's really sort of, you're right. I think it's gaining popularity, and yeah, it's really good that more people are spreading the message. And anyway, because I did a podcast with Jay like a year ago and he only just released it now. And I'd actually been thinking about asking you to come back on the podcast, and it was a good, trigger for me to do it. So yeah, welcome back. Jay's super knowledgeable. You know, I always get lots of good feedback from women, because a lot of women in our program listen to your podcast too. So yeah, go check it out. But I thought today we could talk about perimenopause, menopause, and hormone replacement therapy, because I think it's such a big topic at the moment, and so many of the women who join our program are in their 40s like me, 50s. You know, a lot of them are just advised just take HRT, and I just don't think sometimes doctors really give them the full picture. You know, and some of the, I'm not saying, you know, you need to make the decision for yourself, but I think go into it knowing everything and understanding how it all works and some of the risks as well and the different types. So perhaps, Jay, we can start by, because I feel like, I'm just trying to think about how to articulate this, but from like a bioenergetic perspective versus mainstream medical perspective, what's happening when you go through perimenopause and menopause?
Yeah, I think that's a great starting place. So we see, of course, a major shift in hormones as you know, menstruation stops, ovulation stops, and the kind of reproductive phase comes to a halt, you know, and kind of goes slow, and then stops. And during that time, we'll see as that cycle reduces, we see the kind of lack of fluctuation of the hormones, and then much lower production of the hormones, specifically from the ovaries. So you don't have the estrogen production from the ovaries, and you don't have the progesterone production from the ovaries. And there's, you know, a kind of typical 28-day rhythm there, where those are fluctuating, and they're higher at some points, lower at some points. But once menopause hits, you know, you'll see them really take a nosedive in terms of ovarian production. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no production elsewhere in the body, which is a really important point that we can come back to. But at least in terms of ovarian production, you see that stop. And during that time, you also tend to see various symptoms come up. So hot flashes are a really common one. Mood swings can be a common one as well. And a lot of women will also note that they feel like metabolically things slow down, and maybe they're more prone to weight gain and that whole side of the picture. And so there's a number of things that we can do to help mitigate that, help prevent and reverse some of those effects. And I'm sure we'll talk about those, but that's just kind of the general big picture starting place.
So why do you think, you know, because I get a lot of questions or comments from women, or I just see other people posting on Instagram saying that, you know, I think a common misconception, like during perimenopause anyway, is that it's estrogen that's declining. Can you talk a bit about what's happening with the cycle with estrogen and progesterone in perimenopause?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions kind of all throughout, I think, in the kind of, you know, average person who's just interested in their health, and then also in the medical industry as well. And a lot of it comes from looking at the blood levels of hormones. And it is true that once menopause hits and kind of in the transition there, you do see declining values of the estrogens and progesterone, and you see LH and FSH go up. And what that's really reflecting is what's going on in the reproductive system itself. It's really reflecting that the ovaries are turning down their own production of these hormones. So there is a truth to that, that you're not seeing the cycle, like the cyclical fluctuation of the hormones, and you're seeing a reduction in the ovarian production. But in the rest of the body, especially when it comes to estrogen, there's still quite a bit of local production. So in the adipose tissue and the bones, in different organ systems, you'll still have estrogen being produced, even though you're not going to see it in the blood, at least in the same levels. You'll see much smaller levels, much lower levels in the blood, but you will still have it being produced elsewhere. Progesterone, on the other hand, while it is still produced, is produced in far lower levels. And if we even take a step back here, the reason why I think things are pinned on estrogen in most cases when it comes to perimenopause and menopause is that we're told from the beginning that estrogen is the female hormone. And I think if we were to say there is a female hormone, if anything, it should be progesterone. But at the very least, progesterone is a major, major player in that picture. And so most of the effects that we're seeing during this time have more to do with the declining levels of progesterone rather than the change in estrogen, especially considering when you look at the menstrual cycle and you look at the hormonal levels, estrogen is really only elevated for a short period of time right around ovulation. Aside from that, the levels aren't zero, but they're generally pretty low. Whereas progesterone is one that's obviously elevated for the whole latter couple of weeks and has lasting effects. So a lot of the effects that we're seeing here are typically blamed on the drop in estrogen, but I would say the decrease in progesterone is far more at play or much more to blame.
And can you, just before we move on, just for those people who may not understand what progesterone and estrogen do, because it's not that estrogen's bad, it's just that when it's left unchecked, it can have some negative effects. So can you talk about what each of the hormones do and how progesterone, I guess, helps to like check, I guess, or counterbalance estrogen?
Yeah. On a foundational level, kind of the most basic level, they're both involved in growth and development. And so estrogen helps with the growth of any new tissue, and it's really important for that. And kind of just is a universal basic signal that drives growth. And progesterone instead kind of helps to have helps to guide that growth so that the cells are produced into the right cells and the tissue grows properly and things like that. And so both are important when we're talking on the reproductive side. They're both important for different parts of the menstrual cycle, the growth and development that happens there and the uterine tissue, the lining and all of that. Both hormones are involved in different parts, but then also when we're talking pregnancy, both are very, very important for the growth and development of the fetus. And so that's kind of their fundamental reproductive role. But they also have roles outside of reproduction, so that still kind of relate to those basic foundational roles. So anytime we're trying to drive the growth of any tissue, right, and all of our tissues are growing and repairing at all times, estrogen is involved. And one of the extremes of that, which is often pointed to when it comes to concerns with estrogen therapy, is the kind of uncontrolled growth, which is cancer. And so estrogen also has a pretty strong hand in many forms of cancer as well as a pretty kind of fundamental growth factor. Whereas progesterone tends to be kind of the taming of hormone on estrogen. It tends to calm things down. It tends to help make the growth more directed and prevent the kind of unchecked growth that could happen in something like cancer. And you see that kind of counterbalance happening in a number of different areas in terms of the immune system, for example, where estrogen can have a suppressive effect there, whereas progesterone is supportive in terms of the production of cortisol and serotonin, where you see estrogen as more of a driver there, and progesterone is the hormone that kind of counters that and helps to lower those. And so there's a lot to be said here as far as balance. As you said, both are necessary, both have their place. And typically, when we're seeing the symptoms that are coming about, it's really the unchecked estrogen in the tissues, right? So even though ovarian function decreases, the continual estrogen production in the tissues ends up being a major issue, considering the lack of progesterone when we're talking perimenopause and menopause.
And can you talk about then what are some of, like, say if estrogen becomes unchecked and it's you've got too much estrogen in your system, like what are some of the symptoms that women can experience from, say, estrogen dominance?
Well, so if we're talking like pre-perimenopause, a lot of menstrual cycle symptoms, because that's really the clearest place to see how the hormone balance is. So lack of ovulation can be a big one, PMS, bloating, digestive symptoms, swelling are all really common symptoms, like pre-period, heavy periods, heavy bleeding, clotting. All of those can be signs of excess estrogen dominance. And you can see it at other points during the cycle as well. Again, swelling is a really big one, being prone to putting on body fat, irritability, and mood swings. Those are all some of the kind of common earlier symptoms. Acne can be another big one as well.
And so when women are coming into perimenopause and then going through menopause and some of these typical symptoms that they get, like night sweats and the weight gain and the hot flashes and the insomnia, can you talk about what actually causes those symptoms?
Yeah, so typically, yeah, once we're hitting perimenopause, those are the types of symptoms that'll be showing when we're dealing with this estrogen dominant state. And we typically have two factors going on at the same time. We have this underlying state of this estrogen progesterone imbalance, and then typically the symptoms will correlate with peaks of other or moments of stress from other systems. So, for example, when it comes to the hot flashes, typically it's not just the chronic underlying state of estrogen, or you're getting this flood of estrogen in a moment, in like a particular moment when you have the hot flash, but rather you have this underlying state of estrogen dominance, and then you'll see these spikes of cortisol and adrenaline, our typical stress hormones, because our blood sugars dropped. It's been a long time since we ate. Our last meal, maybe the macros weren't super well balanced, and we'll see that lead to a spike in stress hormones, which will then cause something like the hot flash, which, as you mentioned, those can be really common during the night as well. It can contribute to insomnia. And a lot of times that's also happening for the same reason, right? We're getting these spikes of stress during the night, probably because we're not storing glycogen very well in the liver. Maybe we're not properly fueled. So we want to kind of tackle both sides. We don't necessarily even have to tackle the estrogen side if we do a really good job of managing blood sugar and good sleep hygiene and all of that. We can dramatically improve a lot of these symptoms. But of course, we also want to work on clearing out any excess estrogen and providing some extra progesterone for counterbalance.
Yeah, it's so interesting, like when women come into our program, and I think a lot of women too, they don't realize how stressed they actually are. They've either intentionally been dieting or they're unintentionally undereating. And then, they drink alcohol and they've got emotional stress and they're trying to look after all their kids and then they're trying to exercise. And, they say to me, oh, but I could get away with all this stuff in my 20s, but I'm like, remember when you do this stuff for years and years and years, that stress, it builds, and then they're under muscled, and that chronic, I think they're just doing so much. Like, so many women are just so undernourished and so stressed without even realizing it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many accumulating factors, right? I think many women are estrogen dominant going in the first place. I mean, even starting earlier, you have any particular symptom, sometimes not even related to your menstrual cycle, and birth control is immediately prescribed as if there could be no possible negative side effects to immediately messing with your hormones from a young age and then for maybe decades after. And then, as you said, on top of it, chronic dieting and undernutrition, undersleeping, so much environmental stress. And then we see that accumulating effect over time. And then we lose one of the most protective factors that we have in progesterone. And yeah, it can be a mess at that point.
Can you talk a little bit just before we go into the HRT? Because I get, I was just writing this post about it yesterday. Like, women will come in and they, have been doing keto or low carb. They're very stressed. They're going into perimenopause, like lack of the progesterone. They're under muscled and they become insulin resistant. And then they're so afraid to eat the carbs and they think that the carbs is the issue. But can you talk about what really contributes, like high cortisol, stress, fat in the blood, like what contributes to this insulin resistance and what is it actually? Like, it's not that your body, because I think some women, they're like, oh, I can't eat carbs. I'm like, well, it's not actually the carbs. It's just your cell's inability to utilize the carbohydrates. Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think that's a big topic too.
Yeah, for sure. And that's really the crux of it, right? When we recognize that the problem is an inability to use the carbs, it totally changes the game. Because what most of us are told, especially if we're in the low carb camp, is just the more carbs we eat, the more insulin our body produces, and then it becomes resistant to that with time. It stops, it loses its innate ability to respond to this hormone that it's produced for its whole life. And now you can't properly shuttle the carbs into your tissues, and now it's going to be high, you're going to see high levels of blood sugar. The reality is really kind of the opposite, where over time we have various insults, nutrient deficiencies and endotoxin from the gut and the polyunsaturated fats and seed oils and all sorts of things, heavy metals and stress as a whole, which can interfere with our ability to use carbohydrates, ability to convert those into energy. And when that happens, then the cells inside of our tissues can't take up more carbohydrate, because they're not using it effectively. And so then you see the levels of blood sugar increase. And so this idea that we want to reduce the amount of carbs that we're eating to fix this issue, or I mean, really avoid this issue, is obviously not solving the underlying problem, which is we're not actually using the carbs effectively. Now, part of the irony comes in when we consider that the less carbs we eat, the less efficiently we use them. So, and this is, there's like kind of like a linear effect here, where if you're only eating 50 grams of carbs and then you add some extra carbs and you look at your blood sugar swings on a CGM, you're going to see way bigger spikes and crashes. Whereas if you actually kind of get your body adjusted to utilizing carbs, you're going to have much more stable blood sugar and your insulin sensitivity improves dramatically. So we're being given the exact opposite message of what we want to do in order to fix our ability to use the carbs. Not to mention, we want to make sure we're addressing those other areas too, the nutrient deficiencies and PUFA and all
And
of that.
sleep and the stress. Like, I feel it's so interesting. Like, Craig sometimes will get clients to, like, you test your blood sugar in the morning, like they'll prick their finger, and he just gets them to do it like after they're stressed, and or a bad night's sleep. And they can see, they're like, oh, you're right. Like, obviously, I've had a bad night's sleep. I've been stressed. Cortisol's high. I can actually see it. You're waking up with that higher blood sugar. And I think people, it's like, oh my God, I mean, yes. Carbs and diet, like you say, but the stress. I think stress is a massive one.
Yeah, and that's such a good example. I was actually just talking with a client about this earlier. If you're seeing high blood sugar in the morning, it's been, what, 10 hours or more since you've last eaten carbohydrates. That's not those carbohydrates that you ate 10 hours ago sitting in the bloodstream anymore. That's carbohydrates that are coming from stress. When your body's stressed, it tries to produce more fuel so that it can deal with the stress. And so you drive what's called gluconeogenesis to produce carbohydrates, typically from protein or from amino acids. This is a process that happens in the liver, and then it causes your blood sugar to increase in the morning. But this has nothing to do with the amount of carbs you were eating the day before. Those carbs are long gone. They're stored. They're whether it's stored in glycogen or used in the muscles or body fat or wherever it is. But that blood sugar you're seeing in the morning, that's from the stress. That's a perfect indicator of how much stress you're under.
It's so and I mean, obviously, because we've been doing this for a while, but like, women will come into our program and I sort of try to explain to them, like I give them this example, if you're going to drive a car to the other side of Australia and only put half a tank of fuel in, what's going to happen? They're like, oh, well, it's just going to break down. Like, it's not going to make it. I was like, well, your body, like, imagine if you're not consistently putting enough fuel in, you don't just die. Like, your body just doesn't keel over and die. It releases stress hormones, adrenaline, cortisol to make fuel, to raise blood sugar from muscle and fat. And obviously this is quite stressful in the body. Like, you do need it as a backup because you don't want to just die. But I think women are consistently and constantly running on these stress hormones from undernourishment. But then also, stress. I mean, I even know it myself. Like, I mean, I eat really consistently. Like, eating's not a problem for me. Get sun, take the supplements. I think my biggest issue is if I get stressed about something in work, like it's this emotion, I can feel the stress hormones in my body, regardless of how much food I eat, and then it affects my sleep because I'm thinking, and then I wake up in the morning and I had 6 hours sleep, I'm tired, So it's, I think it's, yeah, women don't realize the effect that these other stresses can have on the body. And obviously, like, fuck, you can't go through life with no bloody stress. Like, that's abnormal. But just having tools and things, you know, to like help you manage, and I guess it's your response to things as well, how you respond to things. Anyway, I went off on a side tangent, but yeah, I think, yeah, you've got to look at everything together when you're looking at this
Absolutely.
age. Yeah.
Yeah. Whether we're talking about the hormone imbalance or we're talking about insulin resistance, stress, sleep, your, you know, environment during the day, are you getting sunlight? And then of course all of the foundations with nutrition and movement and all of that.
So let's go to hormone replacement therapy. So can you talk through like what is hormone replacement therapy? What are the different types that you can take?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a broad umbrella with no concrete definition. What most of the time is prescribed once women are hitting perimenopause and then in menopause is normally a combination of some form of estrogen, some form of progesterone, and some form of testosterone. And then, you know, sometimes it'll just be the estrogen and progesterone. Normally, the practitioner will look at the blood work and say, well, these two are low or these three are low, and let's just replace it. And it's normally not thought of much more than that. Were you going to say something, Kitty?
Oh, I was going to ask, is it always bioidentical? Like the hormones, or sometimes.
No.
Sorry, you go. Yeah.
No, go
Yeah.
ahead.
Yeah. I just think people will ask like the questions that I get asked. Yeah.
So no, it's not always bioidentical. There are other forms that are used. Like, for example, a progestin could be used instead of a bioidentical progesterone.
What's the issue with that then? What's the issue with progestins versus progesterone?
Yeah, so the concern with progestins is that they're synthetic derivatives of progesterone. So they're not the exact progesterone, but they have something added, taken away to kind of change the hormonal structure. And these, you know, our bodies are really tightly tuned to especially these kinds of reproductive hormones. And so there's typically no change that you can make to the hormonal structure without some sort of change in effect. And when it comes to the progestins, they almost always have some sort of estrogenic effect alongside what's called a progestogenic effect. And so typically there's going to be some negative consequences of using that relative to just a real true progesterone or a bioidentical progesterone.
And so what do women typically prescribe? Like, you know, are they su sometimes prescribed just estrogen? Like, what do you find typically women are prescribed?
Yeah, I'm sure that that happens at times, but I think that's really been phased out since. I mean, again, I'm sure there are some practitioners that maybe do that, but I want to say it's been since the 1980s that they started adding progestin in there because what happened, they really started prescribing different forms of estrogen as hormone replacement starting in the 1940s. And it wasn't just hormone replacement, but you know, they advertised it for menopausal women to help with symptoms, and it did. It helped with symptoms. They would prescribe it for women who are still cycling for different kind of, you know, menstrual disorders, they would call them, but different symptoms alongside the menstrual cycle. They would use it for pregnant women who you know, to help them carry, to help prevent miscarriage. And this continued for decades. Until there started to be some studies coming out showing some increased risk of different forms of cancer, of gallbladder disease, you know, various concerns. This was mostly in the 1970s. And so at that point, they started adding in basically what they were considering a counterbalance in progestins. So these were still the synthetic progestins that had some estrogenic effects as well, but they were using them alongside the estrogen. And at this point, they were starting to prescribe them not just for these quote reproductive issues, but also for osteoporosis and then later for heart disease. You know, they were being prescribed to millions and millions of women. And then there were a series of studies that came out throughout the 1980s, 90s, and then especially in the early 2000s that showed with either estrogen only therapy or with estrogen and progestins, there were significant increases in terms of risk of cancer, stroke, blood clots, dementia. And so there were major, major concerns, and they started, you know, the FDA had all these warnings about using these hormones, and so it really kind of fell out of style. Like the number of prescriptions dropped dramatically at that point, precipitously. So I know it's made a pretty decent resurgence, but that's really isolated to, I think, more of the alternative health world. You know, the typical conventional doctors aren't often prescribing HRT, but it's rather become something, you know, for the people who are more interested in their health. And typically it involves some form of estrogen, some form of progesterone or progestin, and then often there will be testosterone or something, some sort of androgen. Normally it's testosterone if it's found to be low on the blood work. I've seen pregnenolone as well used sometimes, but it's the idea is that we're trying to replace these hormones that are low. But I mean, there can be some major negatives to the use of HRT. Maybe we could
Yeah, talk
start to
about. I
touch
was
on.
going to say, maybe start with what is the real risk of just using estrogen on its own, or even estrogen with progestins?
Yeah, so I mean, like we were saying earlier, there's a ton of research showing the negative effects of estrogen and estrogen plus progestins. But as we were talking about earlier, progesterone and estrogen do ha have a counterbalancing effect. Progestin still plays a role there. It does have some progesterone-like effect, but it also has an extra estrogenic effect. I think, I mean, the estrogen on its own is a major concern, as we talked about. Growth that's unchecked can cause things like cancer, can cause things like blood clots, and cause those downstream effects. It has a number of other effects along the kind of growth pathways. It tends to increase fibrosis and calcification, which is not good for our vascular system. It's not good for our nervous system. I mean, really, everything is, it's kind of like degenerating tissue. Kind of like damaging it in a way where it becomes unable to function properly. And so that will happen with large amounts of estrogen on their own. And that's something else that's worth mentioning here is normally the amounts used for these estrogen therapies are pretty significant, like pretty large doses. So that's the first concern. But then if you add progestin in many ways you can see less of a negative effect because you have at least some of that benefit, but we're still getting the negative effect of all this extra estrogen, and then also there's still the extra negative effect of a little bit of the estrogenic effect of the progestin itself. So that's the main kind of concerns with those things. And it should be, you know, I do want to note here, a lot of times it can help with symptoms. It can help
Yeah, I was going
with
to say,
hot
can you talk
flashes.
about like the mechanism, the exact mechanism behind how taking estrogen can help with the symptoms? What's happening in the body?
Yeah, and it's, I think the best analogy or the best way to explain it is with some other analogous hormones and the way that they work. So, for example, we know cortisol is the major stress hormone. When if we're exposed to large amounts of cortisol, we get bone degradation, muscle loss, body fat gain, impaired immune function. You know, we're more susceptible to infections. Pretty much everything goes downhill. It's overall very much a net negative. However, cortisol and its kind of family of cortisone and all of the other steroid hormones, like the corticosteroids, you know, dexamethasone and prednisone and all of these, have a dramatic anti-inflammatory effect. And they're used for all sorts of inflammatory issues or, you know, skin issues. You use it topically, autoimmune conditions. So this is a really good example of something that has a short-term suppressive effect on symptoms. It helps to clear up symptoms, but long-term comes with major, major costs. And that goes to cortisol's role in our body. That's what it's meant to do. When our bodies are under stress, when they're in a suboptimal environment, they release cortisol to help deal with that. It helps to liberate fuel so we can use it properly. It calms down all the inflammatory processes so that we can deal with whatever's going on in the moment. But at the same time, it acts as a signal that this is not an optimal environment, and we need to, over time, if this continues to happen, we need to downregulate our metabolic state. We need to decrease our liver function and immune function, and you know, try to store body fat for future issues that we're going to encounter. And so, it's of course not something that we want to rely on as an anti-inflammatory. And so, we have a similar effect here when it comes to estrogen, where it does help to calm a lot of the symptoms that we're seeing, you know, during not only perimenopause and menopause, but also like menstrual cycle symptoms. You know, it kind of shuts down the entire reproductive system in that situation so that you're not experiencing those kinds of symptoms. But long term, we do see that there's a cost there. And we've seen it for at this point, 80 years of, through 80 years of research and prescribing different forms of estrogens.
And so, what about it? Like, could you get the same benefit or effect from just taking progesterone alone? And why is it okay to just take progesterone? Not okay, but like, not doesn't come with all the risks. I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to jump in quickly and talk a little bit more about our 28-day Rebuild Your Metabolism Challenge. So if you're new here or you've been following me for a while and you've heard me talk about the RYM method, but you haven't jumped in, the 28-day challenge is the perfect way to kickstart your transformation and experience what the RYM method is all about. In 28 days, you're going to learn how to nourish your body, build muscle and strength, lose stubborn body fat, and restore your metabolism using sustainable strategies, all tailored for women over 40. The challenge is designed to show you that real results don't come from deprivation or cutting carbs or fasting or doing endless hours of cardio and HIIT classes. They actually come from fueling your body with pro-metabolic foods, carbohydrates, and building muscle through effective strength training, and then creating sustainable habits that actually work. You're going to learn how to eat more, eat carbs, train smarter, and feel amazing while seeing real progress in 28 days. So if you've been searching for a program that actually works, this is your chance to see how incredible you can feel when you fuel your body and train with intention. So once you sign up, you're going to be invited to the 28-day community platform, which also has the course materials and instructions on how to get set up with our app. So every day, Craig and I spend time answering questions in the community, and we help coach you through the entire process of what to eat, how much to eat, and how to exercise to restore your metabolism, build muscle, and lose body fat sustainably, all while using the new Strength Tracker app to track your progress, your training, and your nutrition. You can jump on our weekly live coaching calls to ask questions and get personalized coaching, or just reach out in the community at any time and ask questions. The calls are recorded and saved to the course materials. So if you can't make it live, don't worry, you can always watch the replays and you get lifetime access to the course materials. We're going to teach you how to set realistic body composition goals, not just weight loss goals, how to set macronutrient targets specific to your goals, and build your own pro-metabolic meal plans. We also have recipe books, meal plan examples, and food lists. We're going to help you customize a training program that fits how many days a week you can train, how long you can train for, what equipment you have access to, and any injuries. And don't worry, we cover everyone. So whether you have zero experience training, you've never set foot in a gym, to you're an advanced lifter that may be potentially not seeing the results that you want. So I'm going to pop a link in the show notes with all the details, and let's get back to the podcast.
Yeah, so progesterone doesn't have the same kind of inherent kind of built-in aspect where it's involved in the response to stress, like estrogen is, because the reason why estrogen has that is because growth is a way that we respond to stress. If we get a cut on our, a cut on our arm, part of the healing response involves growing new tissue to help heal that up. And so that's something that, estrogen and other things that have estrogen-like effects would be involved in. Whereas progesterone is not so tightly tied with that sort of response to stress. So that's part of why it, I mean, they act differently, and we have different hormones that our bodies use for totally different systems and to signal different effects. So when it comes to progesterone, it can help dramatically with a lot of these symptoms. It can help with the irritability, it can help with the hot flashes, it can help with the insomnia especially. And I've seen all of those things, but it's normally not quite as quick of a band-aid, right? With the estrogen therapy, it tends to be something where pretty quickly, pretty reliably, you'll start to see improvement. Whereas with the progesterone, it tends to be something where I think it can help really often with the mood and insomnia side, sometimes with the hot flashes, blood sugar regulation can make a really big difference there. And normally that's the thing that I would emphasize the most. The most is management of blood sugar to keep that steady, to minimize the intensity of the stress hormone release. That tends to help there the most with a background of using progesterone to help clear the estrogen. But that's the other side that can sometimes be a little tricky with progesterone, is that it has that antagonism to estrogen. It has this kind of anti-estrogen effect and helps to lower its production and also helps to increase its clearance from the tissues where it's stored. So we're kind of talking about this earlier, how especially in menopause, the estrogen tends to be produced in all the various tissues, not in the ovaries, but everywhere else, and it tends to be stuck in there. It stays in the tissues. Progesterone helps to increase the release of estrogen from the tissues so that we can clear it out. We can detoxify it in the liver and then clear it out through the bile or through the urine. And while that's a really great thing to have happen, if we're not ready for that, if there's a lot of estrogen being stored and then a lot that gets cleared out, we can see a large flare of symptoms sometimes. And then also, if our detox pathways aren't working too well or our clearance afterward isn't working too well, we can also see symptoms accumulate. If we're dealing with issues at the liver, if we have slow motility, we're not like we're dealing with constipation, we're not having good regular bowel movements, that can cause the reabsorption of a lot of estrogen and prevent us from clearing it. So there's a number of other factors that we need to consider. Often things that I like to make sure that we do before we start with progesterone, because if we just start with progesterone, it is more likely that we can get some side effects.
Yeah, it's and what about thyroid function? Like, 'cause you see a lot of women, they have low thyroid function in their 40s and 50s. Or talk a little bit more about that, how it can, I guess make these symptoms worse.
I think there's a lot of overlap. And sometimes it's tough to identify how much is more on the thyroid side or how much of this is more perimenopause. But there, as you're saying, the reality is that with all of the insults that so many people are experiencing for decades, the way that our body interprets that is as a sign that the environment is not ideal. This is a really stressful environment. It's one that doesn't have a lot of really good food. I don't get that much sleep. It's a pretty rough spot to be in. And so I need to conserve energy. I need to conserve fuel and store more body fat, turn down my energy production, so I have lower energy. And the way that it does that is by turning down our thyroid function. And then we're often left with hypothyroidism, and we're typically told this is, genetic. Maybe one of your parents had it or something like that. So you just need to take some T4 and levothyroxine or Synthroid, and you'll be fine. But the reality is that we're missing two important parts there. We're not actually acknowledging what led us to this place in the first place, which is not just random, it's not just genetics, but rather it's we've provided the signal to our bodies over time. And so by recognizing that, we can start to do the opposite, right? We can start to provide a much better environment, do what we can for stress management and getting enough sleep and getting enough nutrition and exercising properly so we're not burning the candle at both ends. And that can help turn up our thyroid activity. And then also the other side is so often the Synthroid or levothyroxine just makes things worse because that's the inactive thyroid hormone T4, and we need to convert it to the active thyroid hormone T3 in order for it to have its benefits. And yet that conversion is turned down when cortisol is high, when we don't have great liver function, when we're not getting enough carbohydrates. And so many women are just put on that medication, and the assumption is that everything will get better and the lab work looks better. But the reality can be that you're still in a really severely hypothyroid state, and you've got a cold body temperature, and you're not sleeping well. And we start to see this overlap with blood sugar dysregulation and insomnia and low mood. And there's a lot of overlap between those kinds of symptoms and the perimenopause and menopause symptoms.
Would you say, and I just this is just from working with lots of women in our program, that the like I, this is just something that I see, is that the ones that are well-resourced and well-nourished and they've worked on lowering their stress and they get sun and get adequate sleep, they experience very few to little to no symptoms. That's what I see typically. So if you're healthy and you're nourished and you're sleeping, I mean, should we go through perimenopause and menopause and even cycle issues? Same with women in our program who are younger. The ones that this is a good example. A lady, she has endometriosis and she's in her late 30s. And she got on one of my coaching calls last week and she's like, "Oh, Kitty, for the first time in years, my period turned up with no symptoms, normal flow, no pain." And she's like, "It's just fucking amazing." She said, "It's just life changing." And who would have thought that actually eating enough food and getting more sleep and, like, do you believe that if you're healthy, then you should have relatively few symptoms?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you're saying, that goes prior to perimenopause as well. And especially when we're looking at PCOS, endometriosis, situations that are driven by estrogen dominance, by significant amounts of estrogen, we can see incredible improvements there. just by fixing those things, just by fixing, making sure we're well nourished and we're getting good sleep and getting good sunlight. And that show the fact that those help so much tells us a lot about how much we can improve our hormonal state without even needing to touch any hormones at all. So I think that's huge. And then obviously also there is the situation with some of those more severe, maybe someone who has more severe endometriosis, or depending on how it's progressed, where sometimes we do need some extra therapy, some extra support to try to make up for what's gone on prior to that point. And so, the foundations are always going to be the most important that get us the farthest, but sometimes we do need some extra hormonal support or extra
Progesterone, we've seen
interventions.
same in our program. Like when they're doing, we get them to all the basics first, because you're right, if they don't do that, sometimes they experience negative. Maybe talk about why. Why, if you're not well fueled and nourished and you take progesterone, what is it actually doing in your body? Why can you experience some negative symptoms?
Yeah, so I would say there's two primary reasons. First one is related to what we talked about earlier, where we're causing that release of estrogen. But when we're not properly nourished, not only are we typically going to be producing more estrogen because we fall under that stress more, but also liver function is going to be really dramatically reduced. And that's where we detoxify that estrogen. We have to convert it to or add it to other, like add other compounds to it so that we can clear it out of our system. And so that can be reduced. And then the other is typically slow motility and other gut issues like bacterial overgrowths and gut inflammation, intestinal permeability. Those things increase the activity of certain enzymes. There's one in particular called beta glucuronidase, which prevents us from actually excreting the estrogen. It causes us to reabsorb it. And so that can be another reason why, just from the kind of general undernourished, poor gut health, all of those things can lead to symptoms when we start progesterone. But the other is that progesterone has a general pro-metabolic effect, which is one of the really great things about it, is that it increases our metabolic rate, increases our energy production. But if we aren't well fueled enough, we don't have the proper nutrients on board, and then we try to increase our metabolic rate, we're going to be faced, I mean, we're going to be basically trying to hit the gas while we're hitting the brakes at the same time. And so that can cause an increase in stress and an increase in symptoms. Sometimes it can make insomnia worse, or it can cause insomnia. It can cause, even hot flashes during the day, like more frequent hot flashes and more stress symptoms, anxiety, heart racing, those kinds of things.
And if you were a woman who was considering taking HRT and you're going to the doctor, like what questions would you be asking and what things would you be considering?
That's a good question. Unfortunately, the vast majority of women who I talk with in my programs, who are discussing these kinds of things with their doctors, are not finding that they're, even if they provide some of the right questions, they're not always getting helpful answers back, which is part of the issue, right? It's a I think, the most important question always is, could there be any negative side effects? Could there be any long-term effects? If I were to start and then stop this, what might I experience? Like, those are always important starting places, just to get an idea of how much they might be sharing about, or their extent of their knowledge about it. But it's a tough one, because I think most practitioners who I've either interacted with directly, or who I've interacted with, via a client or a member of one of my programs, if they're prescribing HRT, they're normally thinking of it as something that's going to be at least a net positive, if not something that's not going to have any negatives at all. And I think that's really, a disservice to the women in that situation who are just looking for relief from symptoms. And part of the toughest thing is, after having been on estrogen therapies for a long time, the process of getting off is challenging. You have to titrate off very, very slowly. It's normally a multi-month process. And I should say, even before that, when women are on estrogen therapy, we see it reflected in the blood work. We see signs of elevated tissue estrogen. HDL tends to increase, prolactin tends to increase, SHBG tends to increase, a lot of signs of systemic excess estrogenicity. And In the process of working off, it's normally multiple months. You have to go very slowly, and sometimes symptoms do crop up. All the ones that were kind of suppressed by the estrogen start to crop back up. And sometimes with the vengeance, just like we were talking earlier about cortisone, prednisone, prednisolone, like the different glucocorticoids, cortisol is for most people, if they use those and then try to work their way off, the issues come back with the vengeance. And so that can sometimes happen with estrogen therapies too. And it can be a challenge of working off slowly, making sure that we are using a proper dose of progesterone as we do so, and we're also implementing all the strategies to help with the clearance of all that excess estrogen.
Would you say then, or would it be your general recommendation to like, it's not ideal just to take estrogen on its own, that you always want to take progesterone with it, bioidentical progesterone?
At the very least, yeah. At the very least, if not skipping out on the estrogen altogether.
There's another question I was going to ask. Okay, let's talk through. What are some of the things that women can do to help support their body and then support the detoxification? So I think one would be eating adequate calories, getting enough protein, carbohydrates. I think so many women are scared of carbohydrates. I just had a thought, actually. I was having this conversation with a friend of mine on Instagram, and she has endometriosis, and she was just watching a story, and she's like, "Oh, I think I'm estrogen dominant." I just sent her a podcast to listen to. And she made this interesting comment, like, I just can't eat any healthier or restrict myself more. Or I can't. It was just an interesting comment, and I just said to her, well, we'd probably be getting you to do the opposite of what you think is, like back in the day, she's probably eating like me, like, cut out all the fruit, no sugar, no dairy, because it's inflammatory, and really restrictive fasting, cutting breakfast, and it's like all of these things that I think women do to th that they believe are healthy and supporting their bodies actually having the opposite effect.
Yeah, it's the saddest part is seeing so many people get sucked into that. And obviously you and I have both been there and for different reasons, of course, but yeah, it's so frustrating to see that. But yeah, there's so much that can be done to help with the hormonal state and help with both reducing estrogen production and increasing clearance and getting to a much more balanced state. So first one, as you said, making sure that we're getting enough total calories in, getting enough carbohydrates in. A lot of the situation of clearing excess estrogen comes back to liver function, since that's where we detoxify it. And our livers are happy when they have enough carbohydrates. They're very tightly tuned to that, and they're our main storage of carbohydrates for our whole body, except for our muscles. So carbohydrates and liver function tend to go hand in hand, and that's a big part of it. They're also really sensitive to protein intake because a number of the different amino acids in the proteins that we eat are integral to the detoxification processes and pathways that go on in the liver. So getting adequate protein is really important too. And I would say this is really common for women is under-eating protein. Maybe not the ones who are as much health-oriented where it's only protein and nothing else, but for the vast majority of the rest, I think under-eating protein is really, really common. So those are a couple important factors. The next piece, as we were saying, is gut health. And I would say there's two pieces here. So one that I think is maybe a little bit underemphasized sometimes in the bioenergetic sphere is fiber. And getting enough fiber from fruits and cooked vegetables that you tolerate well is really important for binding with the estrogen that's getting cleared from the liver. It helps to make sure that we actually clear it out. Of course, one fiber that's often recommended is the fiber from carrots. So the carrot salad can be fantastic for this. And, I've seen situations where just the carrot salad alone makes a huge difference in terms of hormonal health. So that's a really big one. And aside from that, I mean, pretty much any micronutrient you could think of, like zinc and calcium and selenium, magnesium are all involved in the clearance of excess estrogen. The fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K all have anti-estrogenic effects, meaning that they oppose the effects of estrogen. They also help to reduce the production of estrogen. So getting enough of those is really important. When we're talking vitamin D, that's one that we'll get from the sun. Vitamin A, there's a lot of really great sources, dairy and eggs and liver especially.
Fruit. fresh fruit, the things that we think that we should cut out. I mean, I've like rarely meet anyone, and I was the same. Like, I never ate liver. I rarely ate oysters. I cut dairy out because I thought it was inflammatory and bad. It's so interesting though. I remember when I did my very first consult with Emma, Skourakis, a nutrition coach, and we were just going through all the foods, and I was like, oh, this is so interesting. This is exactly how my grandma used to feed me. So she was the best cook, and we'd have breakfast and she'd cook eggs in like butter, and she'd have the butter sitting on the bench. She'd make homemade bread. She'd actually squeeze oranges for us fresh every morning. It was so yum. She'd cut pawpaw from a tree and she'd pour the oranges over the pawpaw. Lots of roast meats. She'd make, it was gross, but liver on toast with parsley for my grampy. Coffee, homemade custards, ice creams. She'd have like, beautiful salads from her garden, lots of root vegetables. When we had, I remember we'd have roast and she'd cook the, she'd have Brussels sprouts, but they'd be cooked in bacon fat and bits of bacon. And it was just so yum. And I think, yeah, that's just made me think about this. But, like you said about, a lot of people will say to me, oh, about the veggies and the salads and things. And I'm like, oh, I still eat veggies and salads. It's just the reverse now. Whereas before I would eat like, the majority of my diet would be fucking salad and chicken and nuts and seeds and almond milk. And it's not that I'm saying don't eat those things, but like, I feel like the French have it really like nailed, lots of organ meats, dairy, fruits, and they have like, so it's a side dish. The salad, it just adds to the flavor of the meal and crunchiness. It's not like you have this huge green salad with just chicken and a heap of nuts and seeds, or you have like a sprinkling of like pine nuts on some salad or something. So again, it's not that we're saying don't eat salad. It's just don't make salad the majority of your bloody diet. Have the beautiful, yummy lamb shank with the potatoes, and then have some nice greens on the side. Or, like I really, in Thailand, it's so bloody hot. So I make a lot of like salsas and little side salads because it just adds freshness. And they've got beautiful limes over here. So yeah, it's not, it's just having it in the right amounts, I think, is where people go wrong.
And I think being aware of some of, the fact that a lot of raw vegetables have anti-nutrients in there and can cause various issues. I wouldn't recommend doing a lot of raw kale, raw broccoli. We want to make sure that we cook most of those. But yeah, I think side salads are fine. As you said, it's a supplement to the diet. Same with the cooked vegetables too. I think they can be great, and there is just the double-edged sword there on two hands. They're the fact that they could displace all of the nutritious food that we could be eating, so we have to be careful of that. And the other being that for so many people, there are digestive issues that have come up over time. And as a result of that, having a lot of fiber can cause bloating and gas and irritability. And that's normally a sign that there's probably a bacterial overgrowth, and that can then cause a lot of downstream effects. The one of the main toxins from the bacteria is called endotoxin, and endotoxin has direct effects that increase estrogen production. Not to mention, it also has dramatic harmful effects at the liver, so it reduces the clearance of estrogen as well. So if you're dealing with a chronic estrogen dominance situation, endotoxin could be a major driver there. So gut health is really important, and if we're dealing with that issue, having a ton of vegetables or fibers, even really fibrous fruits, could be an issue, and you might need to pare back on those and just identify the ones that you do okay with, maybe lean toward the really easy to digest ones. But we do want to get to a point where we can bring those back in because it helps to maintain a healthy microbiome, helps to keep motility going, and all of that.
And you should do, like, you think if you're relatively healthy, you should be able to eat most foods without issues, Like, I think generally, as long as you're not like eating 2 kilos of raw broccoli, obviously, if I ate that, I'd probably be pretty bloated. But, I digestion's never really been an issue for me. Like, it's always if I'm stressed, it's my sleep or my cycle. Like, it shortens, it's lighter. I don't sleep well. So it's interesting. Like, Craig's, it's digestion is for him, is his sort of sore point. But yeah, I feel like I can pretty much eat anything and never get bloated, which is good. Do good big poos every day, most of the time, unless I'm mega stressed.
Everyone has their different presentation, right? Of where their kind of weaker links are and where, what kind of things affect them. But yeah, it's just something to be aware of with with these different foods. And we do want to get to a point, as you're saying,
Mm.
we like it's a good sign if you can eat those things that you weren't able to eat before. If before they were causing you bloating and gas and now they're not, that's exactly what we're looking for. That's what we're trying to
Yeah.
get to.
What about quickly alcohol? Because I feel like that's a massive thing with women in their 40s and 50s too. The good old booze, the wine, and look, I love a good cocktail every now and then. I love some champagne, but talk about how alcohol can really like find it with the women who are suffering from these symptoms when they drink alcohol. It's much worse.
Yeah, so we're getting into an important area here, which is all the like kind of exogenous estrogens, all the things that we could be even just be eating that can increase estrogen. And alcohol is a huge one. Beer especially is really bad because of a lot of the other kind of compounds in there. But any alcohol will tend to have some pretty strong estrogenic effects and also promotes the growth of harmful bacteria, increases intestinal permeability, and then causes major issues at the liver, which is the one that everybody knows, which then prevents our ability to clear estrogen. So it's hard to overstate how much of an effect alcohol can have, but it fits right in with a lot of the other things that are, I mean, I guess alcohol is not commonly recommended, but if we think of a lot of the kind of health-oriented people, especially with all the plant-based recommendations now, things like soy are really highly recommended. Flax seeds, those both have a lot of really potent estrogenic effects, as do most other beans and legumes and nuts and seeds. There's a lot of those have estrogenic effects. We were just talking broccoli, and cooked broccoli is great, and sure, maybe we could be able to tolerate a bit raw, but the cruciferous vegetables as a whole have estrogenic effects too, especially if they're raw. So if we're dealing with estrogen issues, that there's a swath of different foods. Foods, so to speak, that we'd want to be careful with that can amplify those estrogenic effects. And again, it doesn't mean we're never having broccoli or we're never drinking a sip of alcohol. If we do, there's things we can do to protect ourselves against it. Also, as we were saying, we want to get to a point where we can tolerate these things without it, being an issue. But if we're dealing with really severe estrogen dominance, we're dealing with endometriosis, PCOS, amenorrhea, various other issues, I would eliminate these to the extent that you can for right now while you work on fixing those issues.
One more thing. What about, because talking about estrogenic things, beauty products and creams and makeup and perfumes and all the shit that we, I remember when I met Emma and, I was sort of starting to learn about the stuff. I was like, oh my God, like all of it, my bathroom, my body cream, my face cream, I would spray copious amounts of perfume, fake tan every week.
And we were kind of talking about this earlier with estrogen being kind of on the stress side. It's something that's generally interpreted as a stressful thing. And that's why so many of these synthetic substances in our environment have estrogenic effects. All of those compounds in skincare, especially all the parabens, which at this point are kind of being phased out, like those are some of the more common ones, but the fragrances as well are major, or can be major estrogenic compounds that we're exposed to. I mean, it's really something where you want to look at everything that touches your skin, lotions, moisturizers, makeup, deodorant. There's tons of things in there. Cleaning products, so many factors there. And then, I mean, there's so many more categories to get into here. Plastics are another big one. All of the plasticizers, BPA, BPS, and even if it says it's BPA free, normally it's just replacing BPA with some other compound, and all of those are estrogenic and have endocrine disrupting effects. There's the PFASs, the polyfluoroalkyl alkyl substances that are again in all of these different industrial products and cookware.
Yeah, it's a lot. I would say to women, like, don't get stress yourself out. One thing that, why Emma and I created our skincare was just to create something simple. And I just, because I'm still not perfect. Like, I don't have perfect makeup. But I try and use the body, well, I do, not I try, use the body cream, the face cream, try and, don't wear makeup all the time. I don't really wear perfume anymore ever. Like, maybe if we go out, I'll just spray a little bit on my shirt, because it's nice, but just try to reduce, get the, what is ceramic cookware. We've got some pots and pans that are ceramic, which is good. Use glass containers, try and get some more natural cleaning products.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be like 100% perfect, and I
Yeah.
think these are slightly smaller in terms of importance relative to the things we were talking about earlier, but they are things that are really ubiquitous in our environment. So making those kinds of steps that you mentioned is important. This is a case also where making sure we're getting organic foods as far as the ones that are often sprayed with pesticides go is important. A lot of those pesticides have estrogenic effects. So yeah, it's a matter of doing what you can and just slowly bringing awareness to these things. And the great news is that especially nowadays, there's so many really good products available and replacements for pretty much anything you could use that don't have the estrogenic chemicals in there. So it's a matter of awareness and slowly making steps. You don't have to throw out every single thing in your house right now, but yeah, just trying to take steps in the direction of things that are, again, using more natural materials, more natural ingredients. That's kind of a simple starting place, trying to avoid plastics, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I think just like with the nutrition, like living in Thailand's really helped me with this, but just like obviously Thailand, you don't have access to the same foods in Australia. And so like who fucking knows with the chicken, like and the stuff that's over here, I just like pull the skin off, try and trim the fat off. I just have a small amount of chicken if I'm having I just don't worry about it. I just, the eggs, I'm like, oh fuck, who bloody like you can't buy organic eggs over here. So I just have my two eggs and, the milk as well. The milk is just, at least they've got plain, it's pasteurized, homogenized, but it's got nothing else added, which is good. I take my liver and my oysters and get sun and just do the best that I can. There's no organic, you just go down to the little like fruit shop down the road and you buy the fruit and things. So I just sort of, I just don't stress about it. I just do the best that I can and,
Yeah, there's only so much we can control in our environment. And so we want to do what we can and what we can't, as you said, try to let go of, and stressing about it only makes it worse. But even, there's still choices we can make too, right? When it comes to fruits, there's some that they really don't use much in the way of
Or
pesticides,
you
or
peel
we're not going to
them.
expose ourselves. Right. A lot of the tropical fruits I'm sure you're eating,
Mangoes.
there's not as much of a concern with pesticides. But if we're talking like berries and grapes and cherries and apples, I would be a bit more careful. In a place if those aren't available as, organic fruits. But if that's all you have available for fruit, then it's probably worth having some of those and then some other carb sources too. So yeah, you have to work with what you have available.
That's right. Do the best you can. Yeah, close.
Yeah.
Sometimes close enough is good enough. Don't stress yourself out. But is there anything else that you think I haven't covered that I haven't asked you? I've asked you a lot of questions.
Yeah, we touched on a lot of different things. I mean, nothing in particular comes to mind. There's all sorts of, herbs that could fall on both sides of the spectrum. There's a lot of herbs that are recommended for
Yeah, okay, that's
estrogen
interesting.
issues.
Yeah, so talk about some of them.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the like hormone balancing supplements have herbs that are actually pro-estrogenic or phytoestrogenic. And like DIM is one of the most common ones here. And again, it's kind of really similar. It has that kind of suppressive effect where it can help to suppress symptoms, but it's doing so th mediated through these estrogenic effects. So there's a, I'd be careful with a lot of the herbs that are promoted for estrogen issues. Make sure there's nothing in there that says it's, or I mean, you could try to look these things up and try to make sure there's nothing that would have a phytoestrogenic effect. But on the flip side, there's a lot of herbs that can be really beneficial in this regard. Nettle root, dandelion root, milk thistle. There's a number of really good options too. So it's not a case where you have to like throw the baby out with the bathwater, but just I think an area where there's a lot of misconception.
Awesome. Oh, that was great, Jay. So informative, and I hope everyone learned a lot and you've got a bit more information around HRT and, what questions to ask, how you can support your body through this transition so you can experience much less symptoms. And look, I've just seen it firsthand with like the thousands of women that we've worked with, how many women come in and, even yesterday in Slack, I saw this woman. She'd been sort of doing a fat loss phase, and it's probably, she's got into the end of it. And Craig's like, listen, I think, you're starting to experience some negative symptoms now. Let's put your calories up, and I want you to sit here for a while and let's get your temps and pulses up. And she's someone who really, She was someone like me who was a, like under eater, like really restrictor. And so she's put on a little bit of muscle and she's put on a little bit of body fat, which is difficult for her. But anyway, I just saw her go, oh my God, I've put my calories up. I'm sleeping so much better. My energy's better. My anxiety's gone. You know, it's just, it's still like every day, every, I get on calls with clients in our challenge and, you know, just teaching them the bait, like have a good breakfast with decent amount of protein and carbs, you know, like eat well-balanced meals every 4 to 5 hours. And they're like, okay, well, I followed your examples and I've done a few days in, they're like, I feel like it's life-changing. Like that's the words that they use in their posts. This has been life-changing, Kitty. I don't want to snap at my kids anymore. Who would have thought I could eat all these carbs? You know, like... Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, the transformations are definitely amazing to see, for
Yeah.
sure.
And you get to eat real yummy food. And I feel like that's the best bit. That was the best bit for me. I just love orange juice and oranges and potatoes and sourdough bread. And it's just so good eating all this good food every day.
And to be free from the
Ice cream.
restriction, I mean, what a weight. Yeah, ice cream, of course, but yeah, to be, I mean, it's something that just weighs on you every second of the day.
Oh, it's exhausting. The mind chatter is what a lot of women say to me when they come into room. Like, I'm just exhausted from thinking about food. Now I think about food, but I think about, oh, what am I having for my delicious lunch today? Or I can't wait to, you know, we've got one of those Ninja Creamies and we've been, I made, you wouldn't know these ice creams, but they're in Australia, Paddle Pops, chocolate Paddle Pops. And they were the bomb. Like, we used to eat them heaps as kids, but they were full of shit. But I've made a version of my own in the Ninja Creamy. And then I get like a square of dark chocolate and grate it over the top. And oh my God, every night I sit there, I think, oh, I just fucking love this ice cream. I just never get sick of it. You know, it's just a such a great joy to eat carbohydrates every day.
I think the freedom that that comes from like shedding all the dieting is just massive and makes it a lot easier, as you're saying, like to not be feeling constantly stressed, and yeah, it can just totally change your outlook. So
Yeah, awesome. Oh, well, thanks so much, Jay. I will pop all of Jay's details, like his website and Instagram, his podcast. Go follow him, listen to his podcast. He's got heaps of great episodes. And as always, take a screenshot and share it on Instagram stories and tag me at KOTTYBLOMFIELD. And you can also tag Jay with your biggest takeaways and just, yeah, share it because I just feel like this information, so many women need this information. Yeah. It's life changing.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to
Awesome.
share it. And yeah, and if listeners are looking for a good place to start diet wise, I've got a free energy balance food guide they can download at jfeldmanwellness.com/guide.
Awesome. I'll put the link. I'll go and find all the links and I'll put them in the show notes below. Awesome. Thanks so much, Jay. And I'm sure I'll have you back again on again soon.
Sounds good.
Bye.
Thanks, Kitty.
Thanks so much for listening. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, or leave a review wherever you listen to your podcast. That helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. You can also keep up with your host and find her content on Instagram at KITTYBLOMFIELD. Once again, thanks for tuning in to the Weight Loss for Women podcast, and we hope you'll join us again on the next episode. Until then.